When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Sam Stone came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas. And the time that he served had shattered all his nerves and left a little shrapnel in his knee. But the morphine eased the pain, and the grass grew around his brain and gave him all the confidence he lacked.
That is, of course, John Prine singing Sam Stone. I'm going to play him during this hour because it seems fitting, I think, because John Prine is such a great piece of Americana. My guest is Susan Kelly, who we've been trying to get together forever, haven't we, Susan?
Several months.
Several months. Emails back and forth. I cannot tell you how taken I am with this book, Route 66. It is... photographic essay by Quinta Scott. Is that her name?
Quinta.
Quinta Scott. And the writing by you. You say, I'm going to quote from the book at length. Also, you've recently written The Father of Route 66, the story of Cy Avery, who was one of, I encountered him first in this book. I never heard of him before, but I encountered him in this book about the Route 66. You say, and it's a lovely beginning to the book, the miracle was not the automobile. The miracle of the early 20th century was the construction of a vast network of highways that gave automobiles some place to go. That is a fabulous, fabulous beginning to this book. This book was many years in the making, was it not?
It was. Quinta, the photographer, and I traveled off and on for about 7 years up and down Route 66 interviewing people who'd been in business on the highway. And
why? Let me ask you, what was the seed of this? I mean, I know a lot of people who've driven Route 66, and it's a slice of Americana and all that jazz. But your purpose had to be something deeper.
In Chicago, people talk about Route 66.
Yeah.
I grew up in St. Louis, and my mother had grown up in Southwest Missouri, where Route 66 country. And I worked for a newspaper in St. Louis, and later I worked for the newspaper in Springfield, Missouri. And there's a piece of the old highway west of Springfield that is like a time machine. You're back in the 30s or 40s. There's the little stone tourist courts, the little cafes, and the old road because the interstate's gone off
right,
someplace
sure,
else.
Sure.
And I thought at the time, somebody ought to write a book about this. I'd heard family stories about Route 66. And I came back to St. Louis and was at a party and met Quinta, who was interested in the buildings along Route 66. And I said...
What a serendipitous meeting that was, yeah.
But I said, architecture, you know,
sure.
That's boring.
Right.
You
got
to talk
right.
to the people.
Right, right, right.
And but it was a great combination because at that time, that was before all the renewed interest in Route 66, and the road wasn't marked. And the way we found the road was by the buildings. You know, it would look like an old gas station
wow.
from the 30s, and we'd go in and we'd say, have you been here? You
know? Yeah, so I'm basically, we're kind of like modern-day archaeologists,
right? Yeah, it
was right?
great. And yeah. they'd say, oh, Joe built this building.
Or Joe lives over
and
there.
Joe lives over there. Or, you know, well, actually my uncle did, but I grew up helping him.
You two could not have imagined, I don't think by, and that's probably why it took 7 years, the depth that you were diving into when you did this project? Because I got some, you must have interviewed hundreds of people. There's a list of them in the back. And every one of them, to my mind, as I said when you walked in here, this is like a Stud Sterkel book.
It was great. And because of the time, we would interview people and then we'd come back home I mean, we'd be out for a weekend or a week or whatever it was, and we'd come back home, and I'd verify what they told us. I'd go do the library research to go with it.
Thank God you were a reporter in your previous life.
Well,
thank
I loved God. It. Yeah, you know, but I spent hours sitting on the floor of the Washington University Library with old magazines and old newspapers from the 20s and 30s to learn kind of more about the times. And
but in so doing, it must have been, I mean, sort of like a narcotic for you. I mean, one thing would lead to another. And one thing, what I got out of the book, because I thought, okay, Route 66, there was a TV show, there was a song. I know I've been at the beginning of it. It starts in the Art Institute of Chicago in Michigan. And I've been at the end, at the Santa Monica Pier. That's all I know. So for me and anybody interested in it, this thing was like a gold mine. Yeah.
Let me tell you three stories that two of them I grew up with, and then the third one from my mom. Her grandfather had a farm that fronted on Route 66, and she was a little girl in the late 20s and early 30s. And you remember Ernestine, the Lily Tomlin character?
Oh, sure.
One ringy
sure.
dingy, two ringy dingy. Well, she'd be at her grandfather's farm, and the telephone operators in the little towns, something would happen on Route 66, and they would call. And the kids would hear, and they'd run down to see what was going on Route 66. And Mom talked about seeing circuses go by, of course.
It was days. Sure.
It was also the time when people didn't have any money. She said she remembered a guy walking on stilts up Route 66.
Wow.
She saw the mirror for the Mount Palomar Observatory that had been made in, Corning, New York?
Uh-huh.
It was going west on a flatbed truck really slowly. You know, and the kids followed it. But she also saw, this was my mom and I was a little girl, Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford motoring east on Route 66. And you can imagine,
God.
Down there in southwest Missouri, there was nothing going on.
Yeah.
And Route 66 was the best show in town.
How did it begin? I mean, this Mr. Avery, Cy Avery, of which you've written, the father of Route 66, A Story of Cy Avery, came out in hardcover 2014. But this is a character and a half. I mean, this is like the Steve Jobs of his day, and he's very relatively unrecognized.
Kind of was. What happened was we were talking to people about the highway, and we heard about the very early days when people had to travel with all their car repair equipment and their tents and their frying pans, and they had to hope that they weren't going to get stuck in the mud. And then the 30s, of course, was the years of
the Dust Bowl.
The Dust Bowl and
well, see, that's one of the most haunting.
The Grapes of Wrath.
The most haunting memories, not my personal memory of Route 66, is that scene in The Grapes of Wrath where there's a small diner and the guy decides to leave the waitress an extra 25 cents. It's one of the, I remember it still 40 years ago.
But we heard the stories and we began to say, why Highway 66? Why was it this road? Why wasn't it Highway 40? Or later, you know, the Lincoln Highway, which was the most famous road in the beginning. And people said, Cy Avery invented Highway 66. And they used that word, invented.
Stop, Don. Let me stop you there for a commercial. You're going to be here the whole hour. Your lovely husband is sitting relaxed in a chair nearby. Used to work in Chicago. So we're going to just enjoy these stories about two remarkable books. Route 66, a photographic essay by Quinta Scott, and a text by Susan. Is it Susan Croce, like Jim Croce?
Like Jim Croce.
Susan Croce Kelly, and you'll be hearing music by John Prine. The other book is Father of Route 66, A Story of Cy Avery.
With a purple heart and a monkey on his back, there's a hole in Daddy's arm where all the money goes.
That's John Prine. I'm going to play an entire John Prine song at the end of my conversation with Susan Croce Kelly, the author of Route 66 and of the father of Route 66, A Story of Cy Avery. Basically, Susan, it's like from 1928 to 1985 was the lifetime of this road, basically, wasn't it? Why?
I think you have to start out and talk about mud.
I'm happy to do that.
The roads that we had, which is Indian trails, animal trails, and so forth, wagon roads, weren't cars.
car friendly.
They weren't car friendly, and the mud was just getting impossible. I read one story about two farmers who lived across the road from each other, and they got rarely crossed because the mud was so terrible most of the year. And they were out yelling at each other one day, and they noticed there was a hat in the middle of the road. One of the farmers got a big long pole, and he reached out and he flipped up the hat. There, lo and behold, there
the
was
body
a,
and the,
a face,
oh,
a head.
Come on.
And they said, "Oh my God, man, are you okay?" And he said, "Yeah, I think I'm okay, but I don't know about my horse."
Oh my God. What a
and
good
that's
story.
The kind of yeah, that's yeah, the yeah. kind of mud. Yeah. I mean, cars would get mired in it. So there was this huge push to get hard surfaced roads. And in the beginning, that meant gravel.
Yeah.
But the technology came along kind of at the same time. And for Portland cement, the concrete, reinforced concrete that we have now.
But you tell me, this is long before Eisenhower started the interstate highway
system. Oh, this is, I'm talking about 1908. System.
Yeah.
Henry Ford introduced the Model T in 1908. In 1909, they laid the first concrete pavement.
Good
and
Lord.
That was in a test strip up near Detroit.
Yeah,
right.
Where else, yeah.
So there was this huge push for hard roads. And also a push because people didn't want to pay taxes, and the farmers didn't want to pay taxes in Springfield, Illinois, if it was going to pave roads up by Chicago. So and congressmen didn't know what to do.
Oh, I can't. You do a great job of capturing it, but it was insane.
It was crazy. And then you had people all over the country. Cy Avery, he's my hero because he invented Route 66.
Yeah.
But they said, we've got to have hard roads. And he started at the county level. He started as a road booster and then became a county commissioner and was building county roads and worked behind the scenes to get a new state law passed. And the technology is getting better all the time as all this is going on. And then he became the highway commissioner for Oklahoma, which put him on a national committee. Or on a national group of all the state highway commissioners and engineers and the Federal Bureau of Public Roads people. And they were lobbying Congress. And at the same time, they said the roads that we've got are just crazy. And the Lincoln Highway was the big one. But I call them do-it-yourself highways.
Yeah, obviously, sure.
Because towns, Chicago and St. Louis, would decide that they needed a highway between their roads. And they would call people together from the towns along the way, and they'd say, okay, everybody will kick in a little money and we'll print maps. And then in your towns, you have to keep the road smooth in your town.
You're in charge of this portion of the road.
And that meant gravel or sand and gravel or just getting out and grading it after the rain. And then the sign for the roads, like the Lincoln Highway, was a blue L on a red, white, and blue
patch. Where was that?
The Lincoln Highway? It went across, I think it was south of Chicago, all the way across the country through Nebraska.
Right, I mean, it's still, there's still remnants of it here.
The old Highway 30.
Yeah.
But these signs, the Ozark Trail was one that Avery was involved with. It was a OT with a green background. They painted them on trees. They painted them on fence posts. They'd fade. They'd fall down. Sometimes there would be four or five of these do-it-yourself roads signs all together in the same place. So people would get lost. They'd get dead-ended. The roads were no good. And
but Avery's really was the father of this.
He was. So there was all this turmoil going on. They finally convinced Congress that the feds had to be involved because it was too expensive to pave roads. And in 1916, 100 years ago, the first federal money was appropriated to pave highways.
Wow.
Then World War I intervened, and in 1921 there was another law that said, okay, we'll make this better. You can have federal money to match to pave 7% of the highways in your state, which they figured would be one north-south road and one east-west road that would cross.
Unbelievable.
So people could get from one place to another.
Yeah.
And this association of state highway officials said, wait a minute, you know what's happening? Just because Illinois has an east-west road that's paved, and Indiana has an east-west road that's paved, that doesn't mean that they're going to
connect. Exactly. They do it wherever they want to do it.
So they petitioned the Secretary of Agriculture and said, we've got to have a national network of highways.
Yeah.
And they appointed a committee of 21 to develop from the roads that were there, the roads that would be the through roads across the country.
Yeah.
And out of the 21, Cy Avery of Oklahoma was one. A man named B.H. Pipemeyer of Missouri was one. And a man named Frank Sheets from Illinois was one. So you've got these three guys. And there were about two dozen altogether.
Yeah.
And as people retired or lost their jobs, it was kind of amorphous. But they met in 1925 across the country in the different regions to talk to the local folks and say, you know, which roads should we match? And they developed a map. And the idea was that there would be major east-west transcontinental map roads and north-south roads from Canada to Mexico. And those would be the main roads. And then they would give them numbers. And incidentally, road numbering was a novelty. That idea was invented in Wisconsin in 1919,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And so they appointed a committee of five to number the map. And the committee of five had a guy from South Carolina and a guy from Oregon and Avery from Oklahoma and Pipemeyer from Missouri and Sheets from Illinois. When they got done numbering, they had all decided that the main east-west roads, coast to coast, would end in zero. And the main north-south roads would end in either one or five. And you knew that those were going to be the major roads across the country.
I'd love to have been in a couple of those meetings. They must have been so bizarre.
I mean,
what about number one, number five, number six? Right. So how did Avery pin 66 on this road?
Well, when the map came out, you know, there was this one screwball road that instead of going all the way across the country, it curved up from Los Angeles to Chicago. And when they got the numbering done, the cross-country roads went 10, 20, 30, 40, and 50, 70, 80, and 90 all the way across the country. And the roads between Chicago and Los Angeles had number 60.
This is, ladies and gentlemen, just a bit of what you can get out of Susan Croce Kelly's book. We're going to take a little commercial break, then get some news, and we will carry on. Her two books, one is Route 66, which is a photographic essay by Quinta Scott with text by my guest Susan Croce Kelly, and the other book is Father of Route 66, the story of this guy we've just been talking about, Cy Avery, who looks like this really benign, he looks like, you know, my dentist from when I was a kid. He was a character. We'll be right back. I'm sure you people out there may be fascinated with Route 66, just from the song, from the TV show. You have to have this book by Susan Croce, like Jim Croce Kelly. She writes in the book, it is an astonishingly well-researched book. It took she and her colleagues 7 years to write it. But she writes this, too, in here, which is something I really want to talk about. For 59 years, that highway was a factor in millions of trips, vacations, and relocations. It provided a living to countless men and women, ran down main streets of the hometown of millions more, and figured in a billion personal experiences. It brought wealth and recognition to people like Bobby Troup and John Steinbeck. It brought destruction and death to others who did not respect its twists and turns and peculiarities. After it was routed and numbered, Cyrus Avery had written to the Secretary of Agriculture promising to make Route 66 a highway that the United States would be proud of. Route 66 was that, but over the years it became something more. It became a highway the country could not forget. That's very good writing, Susan. And it's absolutely true, too. This road is somehow stuck in the imaginations of people who couldn't even tell you where it was or what it was. Why is that?
I'm baffled. Yeah. I don't know. But I do know that there was a book came out last year by a woman named Deborah Davis called The Trip, about Andy Warhol's trip down Route 66. And he'd kept all his receipts and his notes, and she tried to recreate the trip before she wrote the book or while she was writing the book. And I saw an interview with her, and people said, well, what was your big takeaway from your trip down Route 66? And she said, there were no Americans. There were all Europeans and Asians.
Wow.
This is not just an American phenomenon. It's worldwide. And I was in Italy several years ago and happened to meet the secretary of the Italian Route 66 Association.
There is an Italian Route 66 Association.
There is a Route 66 festival in Germany this summer.
Well, of course it's there is.
Amazing. But I asked her, I said, what is it? Because I said, you get southwest to St. Louis and there's nothing until you get to the big west. You know, you go through some really, you know, not very interesting country. And she said when she was in school or right out of school, she read On the Road, Jack Kerouac's book.
Sure, sure.
And she said, you know that feeling you have when you're 20, that you can do anything? And she said, that's what Route 66 represents.
Interesting.
Is endless possibilities. And I recently actually met another Italian woman. I gave her my book. She was visiting the United States, and that's what I give people my book.
Sure.
And she said, oh, she said, when I was in college, I was so excited. I took a Greyhound bus down Route 66. And her, and then I asked her, and it was the same thing. It was this sense that this is America. This is the real America.
Yeah.
You know, never mind the cities.
Wow. I think that's interesting, but there is no question that exists.
It resonates. And like I said, I'm kind of baffled. Maybe because I lived in that part of the world and
well,
it's
but
home.
For you, Susan Croce-Kelly, when you, in doing all this intense research and talking to all of these people, and to my mind, you probably know this road as it was better than anybody around. Do you attach a romantic notion to it all?
My romantic notion is with the people that I met.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bobby Troup wrote the song Get Your Kicks on Route 66. And we talked to Bobby Troup. And he said, well, you know, really, he said, it's my wife's story. That was her line, or my former wife. It was her line. Go talk to Cynthia. And Bobby Troup's family had a music publishing company in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And during World War II, he was in the Pacific. And he came home through Hollywood.
Yeah.
And he went back and got his wife and said, I want to be a songwriter. I got to be in Hollywood. Let's go. He packed up and they drove to Chicago and then they drove down Route 66. And somewhere along the way, she said, you know, if you're going to be a songwriter, you should write a song about this trip. How about Get Your Kicks on Route 66?
Come on. That's how the song happened.
And he, when they got to Los Angeles,
he
finished the song. Nat King Cole recorded it. And the rest, of course, is history. But when we were talking to Cynthia Troup, who was a wonderful lady.
Yeah.
She told us this, and then she said, I don't know. She said it was a terrible road. She said it was bad motels, nothing to, you know, bad food, nothing to do. We didn't have any money, you know. That's a lot of people's memory. I mean, at the time.
Yeah.
That's
a
lot of people's memory. Yeah. And it was called, the Road of Death in Spanish, out in the Southwest, near where I grew up. In Missouri, there's a little town called Devil's Elbow because the road was so crooked.
You're right, Susan Croce-Kelly, in the book at the beginning of Chapter 8. Route 66 also had its dark side. After years, people who lived along the highway would refer obliquely to bootleggers, bank robbers, gambling and prostitution operations, and more specifically to speed traps in small towns, dishonest service station operators, and others who seemed to be in the business to cheat the tourists. The most sobering and pervasive tales about U.S. Highway 66, however, had to do with the traffic accidents. This was a danger, and you detail this, the Devil's Elbow in the Ozarks and all this other jazz here. It was dangerous to drive this road, wasn't it?
It was dangerous. And one of the things, I think there's a picture of I can't remember his name, in Amboy, California, in the book, which was a little town in the Mojave Desert. And in the early days, because of money, and a lot of things about Route 66 had to do with how much money it cost to pave the roads and how fast they needed to get them paved. But the highway was wider than the bridges. And you think of these bridges, they had, I don't know what you'd call it, guardrails at the top of the bridges that stuck out from the ends of the bridges. And cars would come tearing through there in the desert, cross one of these bridges.
Smash into the guardrail.
Smash into the guardrails, and sometimes they would impale the drivers. I mean, these were terrible accidents. And this guy in Amboy, this nowhere town in the desert, he said there were seven wreckers in that town, and he had one of them. And he said, I tell you, I was always there first at the accident.
Wow.
That, to me, I mean, we read about the newspaper articles and everything, but when he talked about that, it was like, oh, my gosh, that is just...
Who is, scary. and all the people you met, Susan, and you do have a website, too. You have a neat website.
Thank you.
You do.
Thank you. I had a really
it's
good
Susan
web
design. It's Susan Croce Kelly, if you don't know how to, it's SusanCroceKelly.com. You can buy her books there. You can read more about her there. It's a I think it's a really snazzy website.
Thanks.
What I need to ask you, and all the people you interviewed, you've got some great interviews with women who were very forthright about what it was like there. Who impressed you the most? I mean, there's a real, in some of them, there's a real sort of American fortitude going on there. You know what I mean? These are not whiners and these are not crybabies. It was their life and that's that, right?
That's right. A lot of them had a really good time.
Yeah.
A lot of them had a really hard time. The people that that were the most interesting in the long run weren't the people who were running the businesses, because that was hard work.
Oh.
And the money was hard to come by. But we began to realize that the excitement came from people who were kids. And they worked hard, too.
Yeah.
But if their parents had a motel, they brought ice water to the rooms. You have to remember, we're talking about the 30s course, and
sure,
40s
sure.
and early 50s. And they visited with the people who come along the way. The first thing that we did was a truck stop outside of St. Louis, the Diamonds, if people remember the old Diamonds. And we started trying to interview the people who were coming by, the truckers.
Yeah.
And that day we realized that if you're traveling, you may remember one or two things, but you're focused on where you're going.
Right.
But if you're sitting there on the side of the road, you're paying attention to the river of people that are going by.
Yeah.
And the young people in these different businesses had more time to pay attention.
Sure.
And so that's where we really picked up the excitement of watching the highway grow and change and whatever. But I don't know that there was any one person.
Yeah. I think it's a collective thing. Let's take a commercial break. I want to ask you a couple more questions, and you want to tell me about something,
don't you?
All right, let's take a quick break. Susan Croce Kelly is going to tell me about something. Do go to her website, SusanCroceKelly.com, to get this book and her other book and just learn more about her. She's had an interesting life. She's got a cool, nice husband, too. All right, in the couple minutes I have left with Susan Croce Kelly, we're talking about her Route 66 book, her other book about Cy Avery, the guy who invented Route 66. You can go to SusanCroceKelly.com. Okay, Susan, what do you want to tell me about?
I want to tell you about the first big promotion to make Route 66 famous.
Okay.
After Cy had a fight with the governor of Kentucky and it became Route 66, he and a good buddy said, you know, we've got to have an association to promote the road because we want it to be the first paved road west, which it wasn't, and we want people to drive it because that will bring money down Route 66.
Yeah.
So they hired a publicist who – they went behind the scenes and tried to get bond issues passed for paving, but they hired a publicist, and he was in Oklahoma City. Said, we're going to do maps and we're going to do this. And somebody said, well, how are you going to really make it famous? Somebody in the back said, have a foot race. And they guffawed. And then there were reporters there and they came up and they said, you know, that's not a bad idea. Yeah. There's a promoter named C.C. Pyle. Talk to him. And Red Grange, this famous
football player.
Pyle had convinced Grange to be a pro. And he was a big-time promoter. And they talked to Pyle. And the next thing you knew, there was the great transcontinental – C.C. Pyle's great transcontinental foot race that started in Los Angeles, went up Route 66 to Chicago, and then went to Madison Square Garden in New York. And that's 3,400 miles. It was open to people from all over the world. 199 men started the race. And they went 50 miles a day, 60 miles a day. Pyle had a carnival with him that had belly dancers for a little while, but the men just stayed there and didn't spend any more money, so he sent the belly dancers back to L.A. But there was a snake charmer. There was a genuine Oklahoma mummified outlaw. There was a five-legged pig. There was a two-headed chicken, except that one of the heads kept falling off. It was just all kinds of a tattooed man, and that went along with the runners. And the runners came up Route 66. One of the runners was an actor who'd been in Bible movies, who had a who ran in long robes and had a beard. There was the African tribes that were the cross-country runners. There were some of them. There was five black runners, which at the time was a big deal.
Yeah, rare. Yeah.
And they had a hard time in Oklahoma and Texas.
I'll bet.
One of them was followed with a guy with a shotgun that threatened him not to pass any of the white runners. When they got to Chicago, they were welcomed with open arms. Crowds lined the highway for hundreds of, or not tens of miles coming into town. Bojangles Robinson.
Yeah, Bill Bojangles Robinson.
Came and met the black runners and ran backwards with them into Chicago. They had a big dinner here. Pyle expected money from all the cities to have the runners come in so they could be there. Most of the cities didn't want to give Pyle any money. In Missouri, one of the little towns had anteed up so the runners would come into his town, but another little town gave more money at the last minute. So when the runners came in through the first town that didn't get them, Mr. Pyle was in a luxury van that he slept in. He and Red Grange, and they would meet the press in there.
This is an amazing story.
When they came through the town that had been slighted, the people came out and threw eggs at his van. The guy, the actor, the biblical actor, somewhere in Illinois, he got disqualified from the race because they found him in the trunk of a car instead of running.
This is a good Route 66 story.
It's a great story. But the winners included the top 10. There was $50,000 worth of prizes.
Wow.
The winner, and that was a lot of money, was a guy named Andy Payne, who was a Cherokee Indian from Oklahoma. The man that came in second was from New Jersey. Third prize was a Jamaican man who lived in Canada.
What year was this?
1928.
Good God.
Out of the top 10, there was an Italian, there was a Brit, there was another Canadian. So all the newspapers were writing about their hometown runners.
Yeah.
There were newsreels. This was a worldwide
publicity
stunt.
It sounds like the Olympics, for goodness sake.
And there was a sports writer in Chicago who renamed right away. I think it was Westbrook Pegler was a sports writer at the time.
Yeah, he was in New York, though, but go ahead.
Oh, I thought he was here. But anyway, he named it the Bunyan Derby.
Oh, my God. What a great story.
And it's just...
Well, but there are so many stories.
But that was, you know, why is Route 66 famous? Well, in 1928, people all over the world were hearing about Route 66.
Yeah.
And it's just gone from there.
That is a great story. You're a delightful person. Your husband seems like a very good guy who used to work in Chicago. And you're a good reporter. I mean, that's...
Thank you very much.
That's...
high compliment.
Well, there one day there will be no reporters for newspaper. You're a good newspaper reporter. And the book, Route 66, it's photos by Quinta Scott and text by Susan Croce Kelly. She also has written a book about the man who... It's called The Father of Route 66. Go to her website. It's a cool website, SusanCroceKelly.com. You must get hit up all the time, Susan, by people wanting to know, you know, reporters and other people wanting, you know, to interview you.
A lot of people want to say, yeah. I saw your books. I love your books. But what they say is, let me tell you about my story. Let me tell you about my trip down Route 66. I feel like I wrote a family scrapbook.
Oh, interesting.
Because everybody has a Route 66 story.
I don't. You heard mine. It's like I stand in front of the Art Institute, and then I was once on the Santa Monica Pier. That's all there is to it. It's a pleasure to finally meet you. I'm glad we could finally do this. And next time you and your husband are in town, I'll buy you a drink, and then you can come on the radio show. I will play for you next week, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of John Prine. We got too into this fascinating conversation for me to indulge my John Prine fixation.